Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I'm Graham Davis, the digital editor of the Investors Chronicle, standing in again this week for our editor, John Heumann, who's still missing in action. Joining me today is James Norrington. How are you, James?
I'm good, Graham. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And over the phone line, we've got Alex Newman.
Hi, how's it going there?
We're going to come on to what is a really fascinating feature that you guys have both written in a little while. First of all, I just wanted to look at the news this week and focus on what's been going on. The markets this week following the G20, which basically concluded with very little concrete coming out of it at all. The FTSE 100 hit an 11-month high this week. American indices have been setting new records on an almost daily basis, and all of it built on what most people probably think of fairly rocky foundations. Talking of shaky foundations, let's have a quick look at the news this week. Alex, in particular, I wanted you to tell us a little bit more about Funding Circle. This is a peer-to-peer lender. First of all, for those who may not be aware of it, I mean, this was pretty big news when it came to market last October and raised a decent chunk of money. First of all, let's go back to the beginning. What does it actually do?
Yeah, so Funding Circle, I mean, some of our listeners may even be invested through the platform that Funding Circle has. I mean, hopefully fewer are invested in the company itself. But they, I mean, it's the way to look at it is it's sort of a peer-to-peer lender and a little bit like a debt-focused crowdfunding outfit. So if you're a small business, you can apply for a loan through their site. And they do the vetting and underwriting, and then they link them the small business with funds of a pools of investors who earn interest. I mean, currently on the website, I think it's between 4.5 and 6.5%. And so they match those two groups. Obviously, that's a higher rate than any savings account you're going to get at the moment, and presumably for, you know, slightly lower risk than you might find from equities. On the other side of it, we have this supposed dearth of lending to small businesses. So that's the idea of Funding Circle. As you said, it came to market last October. I think its valuation was something like 1.5 billion, raised 300 million.
This is a big company. So we're talking,
yeah,
it provides corporate loans only. It's not lending to individuals.
No, it's primarily focused on SME businesses, so small and medium enterprises.
Okay, so there's a dearth of lending in that area, but yeah, Unfortunately, what's happened? I mean, what was the news this week? Its shares got hammered.
Yeah, so I mean, the shares really have been hammered since day one. So on the IPO, they fell pretty heavily, which is really, really strange situation. I mean, we had the Uber situation in New York last month when their shares immediately fell below the listing price. But I mean, the share fall was pretty terrible back in October. So the reason for the recent woes, and particularly this week, was it used a first half trading update to essentially halve its full year revenue growth forecast to 20%. So it had been forecasting 40% revenue growth this year. It's a really bad sign for the company because, okay, it's loss making. Investors knew that when it listed. But if you're growing the speed that Funding Circle has been in the past few years, you're prepared to put up with that because presumably you're taking ever greater market share and you're only ever accelerating the arrival of the day when you will actually generate cash. So to significantly contract your expectations for revenues is a really bad sign. The reasons they gave for this was essentially an increased uncertainty economic outlook for loans, and they've also tightened their lending criteria a little bit to higher risk businesses. So not growing really at the clip that they said or they envisioned when they listed less than a year ago.
Presumably this means it's going to take a lot longer to get to profitability.
This is the big question. I mean, on one level, tightening credit requirements and improving raising the lending criteria, you'd think then that you would avoid potentially some impairment losses, and that might in turn boost the appeal of the lending books to investors. But yeah, I mean, if it's going to be a slower route, they're spending so much on expanding the business, then it really does raise questions over profitability. I think Numis is their one of the funding houses which covers them. I think they had a slight pre-tax profit forecast for 2021. So that's three full years after listing. I mean, I think now that probably looks a little bit optimistic, I'd say. And then you've got the obvious questions are, at what point is it going to have to potentially raise funds again, 3 years down the the line if it's growing at a much slower rate.
Yeah, I mean, is this an existential crisis?
Not at the moment, because I mean, they're still pretty cashed up, and obviously there's a huge demand from investors for their loan pools that they can get exposure to. But they're really learning the hard way that demand for loans isn't automatic. So, I mean, small businesses will also make their own calls. And if they're worried about the economic environment, they're less likely to want to double down on expansion plans. They may feel a bit more nervous about going to a lender, whether that's a high street bank or, you know, one of these sort of innovative providers of finance like Funding Circle. So in that sense, it's a real concern. And I'm not quite sure the route from here. I think the shares are sort of down 2/3 on their listing price, but definitely looks like a sort of falling knife scenario rather than a bargain basement entry for potential investors. So we have them on a sell rating, but we'd certainly steer clear.
Yep. Finally on this one, what does Funding Circle need to succeed? Is this just a scale business? It just simply needs the scale, or can it do anything else?
Scale is one question, and they have been expanding into other countries. The other sort of medium term, I suppose, focus they're pushing towards is to gradually automate more and more of their underwriting. So I think they had a plan for by the end, you know, by 2020, something like 50% of new loans would be automated, and obviously that's going to bring, you know, economies of scale and reduce costs massively. If you can automate the lending process, then you cut out a huge cost base. But I mean, given their ability to deliver their business plan to date as a listed company, I mean, I think that looks a little fanciful at the moment. But yeah, I mean, there's obviously an opportunity there. It's obviously the game of lending is sometimes slower than the high growth that they have so far shown, really.
Okay, we're going to move on to that automation in fintech a little bit later with James, actually, and yourself talking about the feature. But first of all, I just wanted to quickly stick with the financials and looking. Obviously, the Woodford saga is dominating the funds world. It rumbled up this week. His equity income fund has been gated for another 28 days. He's also talking about changes at the Patient Capital Investment Trust, job losses at Woodford HQ. Yeah. But the question is the cult of the star fund manager dead? This week, there's a significant move at Jupiter Fund Management involving one of their star fund managers. So tell us a little bit more about Alexander Darwall's decision to leave Jupiter.
Yeah, so I mean, this has been well flagged. I mean, Alexander Darwall, he is the manager of the European funds at Jupiter. So you've got the two open-ended funds, just the European fund and the European Growth Fund. In April, it was announced by Jupiter that he was going to he wanted to step down from managing those funds. So people already knew this was coming. His replacements have already been announced,
but he's setting up on his own.
Yes. What's new this week is that he and a few others from the Jupiter team are going to be setting up a new firm, Devon Equity Management. And it looks like at the moment he's going to be taking his really highly rated, though fairly high fee, Jupiter European Opportunities Fund with him. That's obviously subject to the approval of the fund's board. But it would mean that a relatively high management fee, which is attached to this fund, because I mean his track record is really stellar and he has got lots and lots of followers, is potentially now migrating outside of Jupiter if Devon Equity Management gets appointed to run it, which it looks like at this stage is likely.
Yeah. Now that's an investment trust, so that can be moved fairly easily if the board agree to it.
Yes.
He has billions and billions under management within unit trusts in Jupiter. They can't be moved, though, can they?
I think the last count is 5.5 billion European fund and the 2.4 billion European Growth Fund. They are staying put. They have new managers have been appointed there, and he's also signed as part of what looks like a fairly amicable managed exit. He's signed a deal to not compete with Jupiter for the next 2 years, which would suggest that he's going to be focused on the European Opportunities Fund primarily for the time being.
for investors in Jupiter, it's still, I mean, notwithstanding the fact that a lot of money remains with the business, it's not great news for Jupiter, is it?
No, I mean, it's not necessarily disaster, but it does come in the wake of some outflows from their funds. There have definitely been some questions over the bond fund where there's been some outflows over the last year. So the timing's not great. And it's sort of a knock to the brand, I suppose, is the best way to put it, which kind of explains why on Tuesday, when this was all sort of fully made clear to the market, the shares dropped 9%. I mean, I think Numis calculate that the Jupiter European Opportunity Fund only makes something like a 3% contribution to pre-tax profit. That said, I mean, it's clearly a loss to have one of your star names go, and to also want to set up on his own and really have the sort of controlling hand in being able to take a following with him is definitely a hit to the brand.
Okay, there's one to watch out for there. So he's calling his new fund management company Devon Investment Management rather than Darwall Investment Management.
I can't remember who it was said in the sort of flurry of quotes over the last month that you should never never buy a fund named after the manager. But yeah, that wouldn't be an amazing PR move at this stage. That said, there's a serious point here. I'm sure Leonora will expand on this if they talk about this tomorrow in their funds podcast. But I mean, one of the questions about setting up a boutique fund on your own is that you know you do lose something, and that is presumably the risk and compliance oversight that a fund manager like Jupiter has, and you know that's clearly been one of the talking points from the 5 years since Neil Woodford moved from Invesco to set up his own fund. And was the oversight appropriate there? So that is another question, I suppose, which, you know, is worth investors either in the funds or Jupiter bearing in mind over the next few months.
Okay, thanks, Alex. Now, yourself and James have been busy this week putting together this fantastic feature, FinTech's Big Bang. FinTech, we hear a lot about it. For the uninitiated, what is FinTech?
Okay, so a very loosely defined term, but at the simplest level, the simplest way to think about probably it's the use of technology in financial services. Okay, that doesn't get us too far because technology means almost anything, and financial services encompasses everything from, you know, your current account to derivatives trading, insurance, cross-border payments, you name it. But when we're talking about fintech, we're really looking at the ways that financial services companies and ways of doing finance are being disrupted by new digital technology and also consumer behavior. So to take one example, and examples of, you know, often help to understand what we're talking about here, there's a UK-based private company, a fintech called TransferWise, and they've come up with this pretty novel and elegant solution to cross-border transfers into foreign currency. So at the moment, it's very expensive. It comes with high charges for customers, and, you know, there's sometimes errors with it. The way they do it, essentially, is never letting a payment cross a border. So you make a payment to a transfer bank account in the UK, and TransferWise, if you're sending it to me in Spain, will pay it out of their Spanish account. That reduces the cost of the transaction by 90%. It's great for the customer. It's an elegant solution using digital technology and smart mobile apps to bring it down costs. And that's one example of how a big revenue stream for the incumbent financial system can essentially get brushed aside in a matter of a couple of years. So
it's not reinventing the wheel. It's doing things more efficiently.
Well, it's both. I'm sure James will come on some of the technologies which are really reinventing the wheel. But many of the applications currently in fintech are instances of small, very nimble niche startups, essentially, just attacking one problem or one area of a bank's or financial services company's activities and just perfecting it, really.
Yeah, and what I find interesting was you talk about these neobanks, people like Monzo, Starling, and the like, who are growing fast and trying to sort of replace the whole service of a retail bank. Can they do that, or will they just get bought up by the big banks?
Yeah, I mean, that's really, really interesting question on the neobanks. I mean, the threat here from neobanks, especially, so we're looking at, Monzo, Starling Bank, and N26. There are companies which can, they're private, largely. They can sustain losses for years because they can pull in lots of capital, lots of customers with loss-leading product lines, and just very successfully, and often they have better branding, and of course, the legacy branding of high street banking is not terrific. I mean, they nearly destroyed the world 10 years ago. So, and they're also more nimble. And in terms of their cost bases, they don't have these massive legacy IT systems. So they're able to gain scale quite quickly. And with some of their technology, for example, with TransferWise and their cross-border remittances, or just having better mobile apps or well-integrated business payments software, there's a real challenge here. Whether they'll get swallowed up, I think, is a really interesting question. I mean, M&A in the banking sector, particular, has just been a bit of a dead end when trying to buy scale and increase customer numbers. I'm not so sure about that question, but they're obviously posing a serious challenge, either through cannibalization of the market or really head on just potentially moving to profitability in the coming years.
Because the big banks are spending a huge amount on fintech themselves.
A lot of money. So, I mean, I think Bank of America and JP Morgan, Polar Capital, put a note out saying they're investing something like $3 billion a year. I mean, a good chunk of the $3 billion Lloyds has committed between 2018 and 2020 is going to go on digital innovation. I mean, they see the threat very clearly, and they're responding to it. So this, I mean, really one of the top three priorities for banks, incumbent banks at the moment, is to defend their turf and spend lots. The really big question here is spending money to upgrade your customer's digital experience is, particularly for an investor in the incumbents, I think the key question here is whether spending money to upgrade your customer's digital experience is a lesser investment proposition than, if you're essentially keeping up or responding to the competition, because they're essentially up against everyone who's trying to out-innovate them. That seems like a hard position longer term to defend.
Good news for us as consumers, though.
Well, yes. Yeah, which is not a bad thing.
Mm. Now, it's interesting that you mentioned that private, a lot of these companies are private, so there aren't that many ways into it. There's a couple of ways into it, which you have detailed in the feature through companies or primarily funds. I'm going to leave that for readers to find out for themselves, because I wanted to move on to bring James in here. James, you've looked more at this technological blockchain and the way that can disrupt certainly the financial sector. Tell me a bit more about blockchain.
So blockchain is basically a peer-to-peer network of computer nodes that verify transactions with known algorithms. And once they're verified, they become a block and become part of a ledger, which is permanent and unalterable. And what this does is it opens up a whole new world in terms of verifying transactions. It's the cornerstone of digital currencies. Facebook announced that it tends to launch its Libra currency in 2020. And this is potentially, it's a game changer for the whole financial system.
And what is this disruption for the wider financial sector? What is blockchain going to do, and who is driving this?
Well, there's a couple of, so I spoke to one analyst who said that there's been a lot of I won't use his full word, but it started with bull, spoken about blockchain, its applications, but where we will see it is, so for example, if we look at settlement custody of assets, huge. If you think about creation, redemption of ETF units, multinational investing across borders, the systems we have, like CREST, for example, which is the custody and settlement system that we've had in the UK for securities or Euroclear, they've been around since the early 90s. So this is improving. This will create real back office efficiencies for financial houses. So it potentially creates a profit uplift for those shares. I mean, I don't know whether those savings, I'm quite cynical whether those savings get passed on to retail investors, but if you're shareholders in an asset manager, then potentially it creates some efficiencies and increases the value of those companies potentially.
Sorry, because you've got a figure in here of, I mean, this is a huge figure in here of AI technologies contributing $15.7 trillion by 2030. Now, when people talk about AI people think about little robots stealing your job in the car plant, but actually what we're talking about is more practical, real world.
Well, AI, so blockchain is one of the big aspects of fintech. AI, artificial intelligence, is the other one which captures headlines. Now, that figure, you know, you've got to sort of think about how it's calculated, but really it's so large because this is already happening. Companies like Amazon, Google, they're already using AI. It's about creating efficiencies. It's not necessarily Arnold Schwarzenegger coming to murder you in early life. It's artificial intelligence is about just, you know, taking the rigmarole out of your day-to-day work. It's no company really now, sort of very few companies will employ people to do data input. But what this does is it the person at the end of that process, you know, rather than their time being taken gathering data and forming into information, the AI will do that, and it frees up people to use their intelligence to put information to use and make use of analysis to make things more efficient. And that's why that figure I think is so big. I mean, one of the companies I've looked at in detail, which is a holding of Augmentum FinTech, which is one of the venture capital trusts that we list in the feature. There's a company called Provise, which actually uses AI to speed up payment of invoices. And that frees up working capital, and it shortens working capital cycles, and it's good for banks because it means that lending to small companies becomes less risky because their cash flow is improved, so they're less likely to go bust. So this is where the uplift comes from. So when we see these gargantuan figures, I think it's because, you know, this is something that's already starting to be introduced into our day-to-day lives, and it creates real efficiencies and productivity gains.
I guess even in that example you gave there, that's a huge market globally.
Yeah, it's there's $2.4 trillion of unserved finance demand.
So if you're able to use these techniques.
Exactly, so banks, for example, potentially, we look at, when we're assessing the risk of a bank, we would look at assets to equity. Assets for a bank, of course, are its loans, so are actually risky, or the ratio of deposits of loans to deposits. Now, those thresholds can be higher if it's less risky to lend.
Yep.
This potentially, we talk about fintech being disruptive for banks, incumbent banks, and Alex makes this point in the feature as well. Incumbent banks are actually potentially winners from fintech. It's disruptive in terms of the way we do things, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to kill these companies. Even Facebook, with the Libra currency, they're bringing in partners that are payment providers, that are banks, because, you know, they as part of the ecosystem, they see banks having a role in this. So we talk about disruption. It's an earnings uplifter potentially for banks and big tech. So it's quite fascinating.
Indeed, and the way this feature has been set out with the graphics here showing us the anatomy of a blockchain certainly helped me understand it. But thank you for your explanation as well, James. It is interesting that we talk about Facebook launching a currency, and we talk about these young, small, up-and-coming businesses, but MasterCard, PayPal, Visa, these guys are all in this game as well, and they'll be at the forefront of it.
Oh, they're all over it. I mean, it's their core business, and they can't afford not to be all over it. And it's interesting as well, sort of to Alex's points about these small startups. So there's still big moats. Banks and existing financial institutions, they have big moats. I mean, at the end of the day, the reason that some of the challenger banks have run into trouble is a very core tenant of banking industry is access to funding. You know, since the term funding scheme was switched off, which was brought in, they've struggled, and companies have had to go back and tapping equity markets for funding again and again. By having sort of a smart app and a good user experience, you know, these fundamental issues aren't washed away. Now, something like digital currency coming online and creating new sources of funding, potentially, that is maybe more of a game changer, but that's still a long way off. And the big players are getting involved in this at an early stage, yep. So they're protecting themselves.
Indeed. Fascinating stuff. Thank you very much, both of you. And I would, you know, highly recommend people spend time to read this. It certainly taught me a lot. Elsewhere in this week's issue, Companies editor Mark Robinson has looked at the private equity-backed bid for Merlin Entertainments and questioned whether it is lower than investors could have expected. Algie Hall's stock screen this week looks at six large-cap quality plays. Phil Oakley has looked at Smith and Nephew and asks whether it is a hunter or will find itself hunted. And John Barron, the ever popular John Barron, his investment trust portfolio this month examines the case for exposure to Japan. It is a jam-packed issue this week, available at all good newsagents and online at www.investorschronicle.co.uk. Thank you both, Alex and James, for your contributions, and thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.